At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
First, a word from our sponsor. Film Movement Plus, a streaming service for fans of independent and foreign film, delivers a world of award-winning entertainment, including some of the best movies from prestigious festivals around the globe. Among the hundreds of titles waiting for you to discover are acclaimed films you won't find anywhere else, plus newly restored classics and award-winning shorts with new films added every week. Available on all your favorite devices, including Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire, Film Movement Plus is priced at $5.99 a month. But Watch with Jen listeners can get a 14-day free trial plus 30% off their annual subscription using the promo code GEN30. And starting right now in the streaming service, you can read and watch my in-app film recommendations. It's a diverse and exciting lineup of 6 titles from around the world that I can't wait for you to discover. Sign up today at filmmovementplus.com.
Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.
A film critic for publications such as LA Weekly, New York Magazine, Vulture, The New York Times, and formerly The Village Voice, Vilga Iberi is one of my favorite journalists working today. Additionally, a writer-director known for the films New Guy, Purse Snatcher, and The Barber of Siberia. I had so much fun chatting with him about legal thrillers last spring and was very eager to bring him back on. Vilga, thank you so much for doing this. It is a real honor. How are you doing and how's the year going for you so far?
First of all, thank you for having me. Things are going great. Maybe I shouldn't say things are going great because things are going awfully all over the world. But, you know, I'm hanging in there, still alive, still employed. I mean, those are things that a lot of folks can't say. So, things are okay.
Yes. Considering with all the chaos going on, basically, is what we're saying. Yes.
Yeah. And you might be able to hear my dryer in the background, which might,
it's going to be white noise for everybody. Like, we're soothing you as we're talking about film.
Exactly.
That's what we're doing. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's all intentional. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're one of the best entertainment writers we have right now. I love your engaging, candid interviews and profiles, as well as your excellent analytical pieces. And I always look forward to reading your latest work. So with that in mind, do you have anything in the works right now that you have that might be dropping soon you would like to give us a sneak preview of?
I'm trying to think. Anything big that I have in the works, I'm probably not supposed to talk about.
Okay. Yeah. Don't want to do that.
I mean, there's nothing, nothing super secret or anything like that. Nothing, groundbreaking, but I'm looking forward to the spring movie season.
Okay.
We're living through an interesting time right now because it's the February March period has been when a lot of smaller movies get released nowadays, in part a lot of smaller international films, because I think a lot of them sort of took this window as their release date in hopes that eventually they might land Oscar nominations and a number of films that were shortlisted for the best international feature. For the past couple of months, a number of those films have been coming out. So it's actually like this weirdly rich period for film releases, even though obviously they're not being released all over the country necessarily. New York, it's like that. I don't know if it is like that elsewhere.
Yeah, no, it is true. And they're starting to come out. People are starting to finally hear about these movies and see them. And yeah, it's very exciting, I think. Yeah. Well, for our topic today, we opted to go with a man we both love to watch, and one with two brand new movies out now in the form of The Batman and After Yang. We're talking, of course, about the charismatic Irish character actor Colin Farrell, who has a unique ability to charm and disarm as a handsome leading man and also fully disappear into his roles in the films we selected, including Phone Booth, The New World, Miami Vice, In Bruges, and The Lobster. We'll go deeper into these films one by one in just a moment, but before we do that, I'd love to hear your thoughts, Bilge, on why you think Colin Farrell is such a captivating presence on screen and why audiences continue to find him as much, or if not more, compelling today as they did over 20 years ago when his career began.
That's a big question. As far as Colin Farrell is concerned, I think, well, it's a combination of things. Certainly, you know, as you know, about 20 years ago or however long it was, you know, Hollywood was really trying to turn him into a leading man.
Yeah.
And he certainly has leading man looks. I mean, he's an incredibly good looking individual. So back in 2017, I did a ranking of all of Colin Farrell's performances. And then just recently, I updated it because he'd obviously been in a number of films, number of new films over the years, and he was in two new ones just very recently, as you know. So, but looking over that ranking, first of all, you know, I was reminded of what a huge career he's had.
Yeah.
And also the range of stuff that he's done, but also reminded of just what a wrong foot he got off on, because most of the, it's a ranked list. So it starts all the way from the bottom,
from
worst film to his best. And the early parts of the list are just full of these like total misfires from the early part of his career where they were trying to turn him into a star. And you'll see that. And I mean, the worst film on the list and still the worst Colin Farrell film I've seen is American Outlaws, where he plays Jesse James. And it's been a while since I've seen it. But the thing I will always remember from it is he looks so good in that movie. I mean, he is a beautiful, beautiful, you know, and he, I mean, Colin Farrell almost always looks great, but in American Outlaws, he looks so good. It's like he's animated. and it's funny because you see that and you think to yourself, yeah, you know, like a guy who looks like that, of course he should be a star. Mm-hmm. But then like as over the years, as you watch the performances that he's done, it's like the kind of movie star action hero type parts that he's done are the ones where with a few very notable exceptions, he tends to get lost in those. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I think he has come to terms with that. I think he clearly has incredible self-awareness nowadays, given the types of projects that he takes. I mean, it's weird because now it's like, it used to be many years ago, if you saw Colin Farrell listed in the cast, you know, part of you died because you were like, oh God, this is going to be one of those things where like they couldn't get a Brad Pitt or something. And now you see Colin Farrell listed and you're like, oh, that's going to be interesting. Like he's in it. Even the bad films that he's in now.
Yeah.
He's like the best thing in them. And so that's, you know, it's a very interesting career trajectory.
It really is. Yeah. Starting out, I was going to say, when you mentioned the worst films, I was like American Outlaws and SWAT, those first ones where he was still finding his footing and they didn't really know how to use him properly. I mean, you just kind of strike while the iron's hot and take any jobs you get. And he was playing the game. I mean, he's super photogenic. There's this great line that like Sofia Coppola said a few years ago when she was casting The Beguiled. She was asking moms at drop-off, like, who do you fantasize about? Like smart moms, you know, like who does, you know, a woman in their 40s, intelligent women, and it's all Colin Farrell. And so she knew that was who she needed to get. And so obviously he's a very handsome man and, you know, he's been in those roles all along, but it wasn't until I started to see, you know, Phone Booth, which is one of the films we're going to talk about today, or A Home at the End of the World, when he started to take some of these risks or really go for gutsy material, that you realized, woo, he actually, there's some stuff here. He's got, some real skill. I mean, he was always fun, even in stuff like Daredevil, which was a misfire, you know, but he was just having a ball in that and having so much fun. And, you know, kind of whenever he was on the screen, you couldn't take your eyes off of him. But movies are a disaster back then. So I'm glad he found his footing. And now he does. He's the draw. Yeah.
And Daredevil is kind of the model almost for what he would do later. Like at the time, Daredevil felt like a weird, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, it felt kind of like an exception. I mean, not a good film, obviously. And he's not even the main villain in it. He's like the secondary villain.
Yeah.
But time he was on screen, he might even be the tertiary. I don't remember the film that well. But every time he was on screen, you were like, oh, now we're having fun. And then he'd be gone. And it's like the movie just like slows, you know, comes
just
to a complete
dies.
Dead stop. Yeah. And that's actually, I have seen a number of films in the past few years where that is the case with Colin Farrell. You know, he'll be in these movies and it's, but in these cases, it seems like he's almost been cast to steal the show because he's giving such a much more flamboyant performance than a lot of other people. It's weird because obviously the films aren't aware that they're bad, but for some reason, somewhere subconsciously, they've been like, let's put Colin Farrell in this to sort of remind everybody that they're supposed to be having fun. you know? Like movies like a movie like Ava, the Jessica Chastain hit woman action film that, you know, that came out a couple of years ago and I think was on the shelf for a little while, but you know, it's a terrible movie.
Yeah, I think you were right. Yeah.
But he's fantastic. He's really good in it. And there's like a scene, it's weird because that movie also co-stars John Malkovich. And there's a scene in that film where it's just Colin Farrell and John Malkovich fighting. And it's like Jessica Chastain and her problems are completely gone from the plot for like 5 minutes. And it's the two of them just, you know, two of our greatest hams just wailing at each other. It's perfect. And then it's back to the movie. Yeah. And something like that happened similarly, I think, in Guy Ritchie's The Gentleman, which some people do like that movie. I did not like it. But you know, Colin Farrell shows up, you know, he plays this character named Coach. And it's such an, you know, like the character is decidedly different from everyone else in the movie. Mm-hmm. And every time he's on screen, it's like, oh, this is what the movie was supposed to be like. And then, you know, so. Anyway, yeah. Colin Farrell, scene stealer.
He is a scene stealer. And one of the interviews I was watching for research today, it's like this 40-minute interview. I think it was after the Lobster. And he was talking about his career. And he was joking about some of the bad movies he was in. And he was saying, like, he wants to at least do his best. Because what doesn't feel good is if you run into somebody and you realize, okay, to go out, they had to hire a babysitter. It's probably their first date night in like 3 weeks. They go, and if they see your movie and it's shit, then they've just like wasted all that money and their time. And you don't want to do that. And he said, so if somebody comes up to me and is like, you owe me $10, I'd probably give them the $10 and apologize. And so when you're talking about he's going to go all out, and I think he really does. Yeah.
Yeah. He makes it worth it. It's weird. I mean, you watch a bad film and then, but like he makes it worth it. Yeah, like I said, that's a reversal from back in the day when like something like Total Recall, you know, when they tried to remake Total Recall and cast him in the Arnold Schwarzenegger part, and it was just a disaster, just a lifeless disaster. And he seemed to have no idea what he was doing or why he was there. And it was just, it was sad, you know, and that's actually, I think one of the other reasons why we love Colin Farrell so much is because he's, I don't know if we can say it's been like a public failure for him, but they tried to turn him into a star. It didn't work. He was in movie after movie that didn't work. But somehow before our very eyes, he has found his place. And it's not even a place because he still has incredible range. He can do all sorts of things. Like, I mean, he's in After Yang and The Batman, and I can't think of two more different movies or two more different characters or two more different performances. So he's still able to do that. So it's not a case of a character, just like of an actor, like a character actor who finds a niche and just does that.
Stays with it.
He's still doing, you know, big important work, but he's like doing it really well. And so I think we just kind of get the warm and fuzzies when we see him now, because he's like, he figured it out, you know, he figured it out, and we kind of figured it out along with him. And now he's great. Now we love him. Now it's Colin Farrell, you know?
Yeah.
You know, once upon a time he had like the sex tape. I mean, he was always, you know, seen partying, and he, you know, he had addiction issues.
Yeah.
He had addiction. Now he goes viral for, you know, they see him, you know, we get pictures of him in short shorts, you know, hiking with Koryanka Kilcher, and it's like, it's just so nice.
Or it's not what we would have expected, like in that mid-aught period when you were worried, you were like, you know, when he was, I don't remember making Miami Vice, and it was a scary time.
And of course the fact that Miami Vice and The New World, you know, two movies that we'll obviously talk about today,
but
those films have kind of become appreciated much more now, that helps as well, because you could argue that those two movies career-wise were like his low point, because they were flops. I mean, he was just, you know, he was a complete mess. I mean, he's talked about how he went straight into rehab after Miami Vice and doesn't actually remember making the movie, so you know, like, they were kind of a low point for him in his life, and yet weirdly they are also two of his greatest performances. What does that say?
He's just that good, and he picks good material. Well, going chronologically through our titles, we have the first film that really made me sit up and take notice of Colin Farrell, and what feels at times, particularly until Forrest Whitaker arrives on the scene, like a chaotic yet riveting one-man show, reuniting with his Tigerland director, Joel Schumacher, in the 2002 thriller Phone Booth, which was delayed from release for several months due to the DC sniper attacks. The film finds Farrell cast as a cocky and manipulative New York City publicist who is held hostage in a phone booth by a mostly unseen sniper, ominously voiced by Kiefer Sutherland, who gives him an increasingly dangerous series of commands he must follow or else he'll be killed. Caught in a duplicitous love triangle of his own making, involving wife Radha Mitchell and an inspiring actress played by Katie Holmes, throughout the span of its stressful 81-minute running time, Farrell gets his comeuppance for his deceit and also finds himself in a second line of fire when he draws a crowd and a police presence headed up by a compassionate NYPD captain played by Forrest Whitaker. A box office hit in its spring 2003 release that garnered largely positive reviews, particularly where Colin Farrell's performance was concerned. Let's go ahead and kick it off. So, Bilga, talk to me about Phone Booth.
It's interesting that you say it got largely positive reviews. I remember it as a film that people didn't like for some reason, but I don't know that I was necessarily reading the reviews. It might just be that kind of like, you know, the small circle of snotty critics I rolled with, some of whom you might know. I think maybe it was dismissed in that among those folks. But I remember really liking it when I saw it. And, you know, the description makes it sound like it's like claustrophobic and minimalist, but this is Joel Schumacher, so it is absolutely not minimalist. And there's no, like, he's not going to bother with claustrophobia. This thing is just like cutting all over the place. The character, you know, the camera is just like, you know, tracking all over. Like, it's totally maximalist style. There's no sort of interiority or austerity. There's no sense that he's like really trapped in that. Like, he is, I mean, once the cops come, of course, and before the cops come, you know, a group of prostitutes start like hounding him. There's like constant cutaways to the street. I mean, it is just gonzo stylization. The film does everything but put you inside that phone booth. But Farrell is so good. Like, he's so good at conveying that character's just sleazy, neurotic anxiety that it's like the claustrophobia is in the performance as opposed to anything else in the film.
That's a good point.
And the thing that you know, his character is super annoying.
He is.
And he kind of has to be. Mm-hmm. Like, he kind of has to be, because, you know, the plot turns on so many sort of unlikely character choices or lack of choice. Like, it's a totally far-fetched storyline.
Yeah.
And but in order to in order for us to buy it, we kind of have to accept this guy as, one, not very smart, two, incredibly selfish, but also kind of, you know, sort of just like a little spineless as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's very good at doing it. Like, I remember when the film first starts, you're kind of like, oh God, this guy is just a complete tool. Are we really going to just watch this dude for the next hour and a half?
Yes.
But he sort of needs to be like that in order to sell the storyline of him. Like, he's there and he's on the phone and he's not going to get off, or he's not going to run, or he's not, it's weird. But he's very good at that. And the film sort of works its way towards some kind of, you know, character catharsis, in terms of him recognizing that he's a tool. But yeah, you know, it's kind of a delightful movie.
Yeah, it is so kooky. I think with the positive reviews, it was mostly just positive about him. Right. I think most critics were like, okay, this is so bogus. You know, like, this, don't think about it too hard. It makes no sense. But, you know, it's his movie to lose. And he just completely steps up to the plate and knocks it right out of the park. You know, it is Schumacher, so it's like campy. And at first, I remember when I was watching it, it was like, well, this is a lot. It's like too muchness, which is just so Joel Schumacher.
Yeah.
And, you know, on scale to 1 to 10, he's going to move it to 200, basically.
Yeah.
And so, like, the scene with the prostitutes, it's a little cringy. It's a little too much. Like, you're not sure where to look, because the camera keeps moving, and you mentioned the messy cuts, which kind of goes to that old, you know, trick of, you know, messy cuts and not knowing what's going on, because he's out of control himself. And so it puts you out of control right with it. But I think it's just, you know, the company of the actors. And like I say, once we're able to get the other people into the equation, especially Forest Whitaker, you can kind of take a breath a little bit. I mean, it's still stressful, but it's also interesting that this was around the same time as 24, because it's a totally different thing. The TV show with Kiefer Sutherland, his voice, but yet it's that, you know, real time or near real time. I mean, they're kind of cheating there, and what they're doing with the voice and split screens and anything, all the tricks he can like throw at you, he's going to do it. Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's a character who really doesn't exist. I mean, I don't know. I've known publicists. And
they're not like some, that. Yes.
But also I've known, you know, like some powerful publicists in my day. They're not like that. I mean, and you know, I mean, the opening scene is him like walking through the middle of Times Square, you know, like on the cell phone, just like yelling at people. And, you know, it's just like this idea of publicists that's such an outdated and weirdly corny, like nobody actually believes that they're like that. And I'd forgotten that he was a publicist. And rewatching the movie, I was like, oh right, he's a publicist. Like that's sort of how you imagine Hollywood agents. And that, they're not like that either. But it's like, that's, you know, you kind of imagine like a Jeremy Piven type, you know, sleazebag kind of thing. But this guy's a publicist, and it seems like he's not even all that good a publicist. And he's got the guy that he works for him who he doesn't pay. It's just, it shouldn't work.
But it works beautifully
because it's Colin Farrell. And you know, that's the other thing about Colin Farrell is that, I mean, I talked about this. I mean, obviously he's an incredibly good looking man, obviously, but he's also got a really interesting face. Like, he's got one of those. I mean, he's one of those actors who, like, every single part of his face seems capable of moving on its own. I mean, he's got the most incredible eyebrows I've ever seen. That can, you know, that
so
thing that people can do,
right?
where the center of the eyebrows can, you know, I don't know, that sort of pleading look that people. Yes. I can't do it. I can't do it. Only the far edges of my eyebrows go up, but the close part of, I'm sure there's a term for this. But like, people can do that, But Colin Farrell can do it to an almost comical degree. Like they like they go up an inch, and I've never seen anybody able to do that. Yeah. Like in real life or on screen. And it's kind of incredible. So he's got this incredibly animated face. He can do so much with it. Which is interesting also because later he, you know, some, as we'll discover, other directors actually use him in a very deadpan way, which I find is fascinating. But he's got such a, you know, expressive face that you can, you know, you can build an entire movie around Colin Farrell's face. And that's kind of what this movie is.
Yeah, he's very emotionally accessible. He can access a lot and make you really believe it. I'm glad you brought up the eyebrows because, my goodness, yes, they are so expressive. And I mean, we're going to get into it with in Bruges, where he's kind of playing several different emotions at once. And you see them play out, like what he's saying doesn't really match the face or how he's taking in information at the same time from the Brendan Gleeson character. And yeah, there's always a lot going on under the surface. And this is kind of the first indication of, I mean, Schumacher had worked with him before, but knowing how to tap into that and what this guy could do.
It's really, it's really kind of incredible what he's capable of. And, you know, every once in a while, a filmmaker discovers that. And they do wonderful things with it.
Yes. Like our next one, which is my favorite Colin Farrell movie, my favorite Terrence Malick movie. So next up, as I said, it is my favorite Terrence Malick film, although he is a master. So there are a few others just a fraction behind that I adore nearly as much. The film equivalent of a full body swoon. It is the sweeping, sensual historical drama, The New World, which chronicles the founding of the Jamestown, Virginia settlement and arrival of the Royal English Charter sent to create a colony in the New World in 1607, centered on the relationship between Farrell's Captain John Smith and the inquisitive and adventurous daughter Pocahontas, played by Corianka Kilcher, the Native American chief, played by August Schellenberg. The film, which is gorgeously shot by Emmanuel Lubezki, co-stars Christopher Plummer, Christian Bale, Wes Studi, David Thewlis, Noah Taylor, Ben Chaplin, Eddie Marsand, Ben Mendelsohn, and more, notable for its focus on historical authenticity and its depiction of the events, and particularly the costumes, language, and more of its native characters, especially Pocahontas, who feels much more three-dimensional than stereotypical and misogynistic representations of the past. Obviously, I would love to hear your thoughts on this one because I read your essay, English Speakers, today, and I was completely blown away. My God. Like, you read that and you're like, okay, nobody else needs to write about this film. Yeah.
Well, I haven't read that essay in a while, so you might have to remind me what I said.
Amazing.
But I do remember the thing that the scene around which I built that essay, I remember, because that's, I think, I think that might actually be the best, you know, as far as just scenes are concerned, the best acting job Colin Farrell has ever done, where they're sort of they're trying to, you know, she's trying to teach him words and they're kind of doing, you know, and this. The look on his face.
Oh my God. Yes.
Where he's sort of, you know, where he's teaching her these words and he's clearly falling in love.
Yeah.
But it's this like weird, like he almost can't believe that it's happening.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I mean, there's great joy there, but there's also a weird wince of pain.
Because he worries.
Because it's almost like he's, and I don't know if that's necessarily because Malick is trying to say that Captain John Smith would know this, but it's almost like he's like representing like what's going to happen to her and her culture, you know? And that's a very Malick thing. Like a character might come to represent something or come to embody something without the character themselves necessarily knowing it, just through performance or just through movement or just through a glance or something like that, which is why, you know, he's such a uniquely cinematic filmmaker, as opposed to, you know, people will often accuse Malick of being a literary filmmaker because there's so much like talking and ruminating and voiceover in his films, but it's actually quite the opposite. I think he's probably the most cinematic filmmaker we have working today. But yeah, I mean, Colin Farrell is fantastic in the film, but he's also, I think, you know, he's also used very well, because once Christian Bale comes on the scene as John Rolfe, and he's also fantastic. I mean, I actually think might also be Christian Bale's best performance.
Yes.
Or one of them. And the contrast between the two is remarkable. And so it's like Colin Farrell not only gives a great performance, but then the memory of his performance after he sort of, he doesn't entirely leave the scene because he comes back later, but the, sort of when he leaves the scene and Christian Bale comes along, like even the memory of his performance changes as you watch the film. It's kind of a remarkable thing. And you know, he has to do so much again, so much with just his face, even though there's a lot of voiceover, we don't get to see him talk that much.
No, it isn't a very verbal performance. Yeah. And that scene that actually is in your essay or inspired it is the one watching it this time again, which I do think it's the best scene in the film as far as the love story is concerned, because you do see him playing a bunch of different emotions at the same moment. Like there is this apprehensive quality of, I am teaching her something. This might then lead to harm for her, her people, also maybe the end of our relationship or where it could go. Does she fully understand what I'm saying? Also, you know, the idyllic, the Malick thing of nature versus man, and, you know, the motives of man and corruption, and also just the beats that he uses, some of the words, like there are only a few words that he says in that moment where he's like talking about eyes, where he doesn't even really make eye contact with her because it's like he's embarrassed, especially when he gets to mouth or lips. I can't remember exactly which one it was, but that is like he was almost embarrassed by saying that to her because it was too intimate. And you know, expressing his own affection for her and what is this dynamic between them. And it's really beautiful. Yeah, Christian Bale's character is just far more open. He's the more verbal of them. I mean, still, it's a quieter performance than usual. It is Malick. And, you know, he is, as you were mentioning, cinematic. It really is also just what he does with sound and the sound of birds, the sound of wind. I mean, it's a whole experience. You really feel it all around you. And it's, yeah, it just completely takes you away. I just love this film.
Yeah. It's, I think in all of Malick's films, or at least maybe sort of all his latter day films, which by which I mean, of course, you know, like post Days of Heaven. which is weird because it's like he made those two films and then years later he made these others, and we think of I think of him as latter day because I was there for years, like waiting to see if Terrence Malick would ever come back. And he did. He came back with a vengeance. But in all those films, I think there is a point of view, or I don't know if it's a predominant point of view, but there's always this point of view of people who kind of, you know, are aware that they're in the middle of something that is wonderful, that they are going to lose very soon.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. That sense that none of this will last. I mean, the idea of the lost paradise, obviously, he structures all his films around that idea. And it's amazing how compelling it still is. Like he keeps doing it over and over and over. And every time he does it, the motherfucker gets me. Like I know the formula at this point, but I'm just like, every time he does it, he gets me, because it's such a resonant and relevant idea for any human, I think. And I think that's what he's captured, which is that this is like kind of the state of humanity, which is we find these moments of beauty and grace and we lose them, and that's kind of life, right? And I think something about Colin Farrell, and I don't know if it's because of how expressive his face is, and also almost like the shape of his face, where there's this like, it's a combination of confidence and melancholy. Like, there's something very sad about his demeanor in so many of these films, and some of that's just the way he's directed. Some of that's the way the character is, but I think some of it's also just the way he is, maybe. You know, or not necessarily the way he is, but just the shape of his face. There's something sad about the shape of his face, despite the joy it might bring us. You know, and these filmmakers, because I think Mann manages to do that as well, Michael Mann with Miami Vice, because again, you know, I mean, Michael Mann is a very different director from Terrence Malick, and yet I think he also captures the sense of somebody who's in the middle of something that he knows can't last, that he knows won't last, that he knows might not even be a good thing ultimately, but can't help but sort of embrace it, you know, in that moment. And so that fleeting quality to these movies and to these stories and to these performances, you know, that's one of the reasons why I can't imagine other actors being able to pull this part off. I'm sure there are some, but like, I can't imagine, and it's not, no knock on these actors, but like, you know, a Brad Pitt or even a Daniel Day-Lewis or something like that. I mean, I'm sure these are all great actors, obviously.
Yeah.
And these filmmakers have made movies with these actors. So it's not like they can't work within this context, but there's something about Colin Farrell that speaks to this like very fleeting quality of this emotional moment in these films.
Yeah, he's the perfect vehicle for that idea of wanting to stay in the present, but knowing you can't.
Yeah.
This is kind of fitting because today I talked to a friend who happened to be in The Thin Red Line, and he was telling me about Malick today. I just rewatched The Thin Red Line last week because I'm actually writing a piece on Elias Koteas. Okay. And so when I was doing that, then I had watched The New World, and then I was like, well, now I got to go back and I got to watch Days of Heaven, and now I want to watch all of them. Mm-hmm. But there is this great thing about living in the present. But when I was a friend, he was talking about when they were making The Thin Red Line and just what Malick is like, where talking about something and then a butterfly just happens to come right by and he's going to watch it. And, you know, he wants to live in the present and, you know, there's nobody like him. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's Colin Farrell talking about the osprey, you know, like,
oh, really?
I mean, no, but like that's Malick's thing, which is, you know, he's immediately distracted by like a bird or something like that. He's a famous bird watcher, I believe. So like specifically birds he's obsessed with. But he's, that's the nature of the film. Like you can, you know, like if you watch the films, you could kind of guess that that's the kind of person that made them. I was going to say the other actor that I think managed to do that with Malick and I think has that same quality, although is not nearly as good an actor, is, you know, Jim Caviezel, you know, and who has since, you know, gone completely
off the rails. Yep.
QAnon crazy. But I mean, he was always kind of a little nutty, but he's actually he also captured that quality in The Thin Red Line. Mm-hmm. Thin Red Line would be an interesting movie with Colin Farrell in the part of Wit. He would actually be really good in it. I mean, he's kind of doing the same thing with John Smith, you know?
Yeah. When I watched them in quick succession, I was just thinking that opening. It was like,
he's in the brig. Wow. Yep. It starts off in the brig, you know?
Yeah.
And we're told that he's like just a really sort of rough, tough, you know, bad dude who winds up, you know, in chains constantly. And we never actually see that. Like they never come across that way, but that's what we're told. And there's a sort of very wild, wild quality to them still.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, The New World is just a perfect movie. I also love Koryanka Kilcher in this. She is so good.
She's fantastic.
I read that she and Colin Farrell were kind of kept purposely apart until they shared scenes together, which I found really interesting.
Interesting.
To capture that moment of, you know, who is this other person I'm working with? And I love that idea. Yeah. So he's very organic and wants to just play on emotion and being in the present. Yep.
Yeah. No, it's a phenomenal film. And the thing I sometimes will tell people about is, you know, when I saw it, I first saw it at a press screening for a small group of press. And that was back when it was 150 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually showed it, they were showing it for like awards purposes. It was at the end of the year. And then Malik actually recut it. Mm-hmm. He cut it to 135 minutes. And then they had another press screening, and this time it wasn't just a small press screening for a few critics. This time it was actually like an all media. So there's like a bunch of people, and there's like people from outside, you know, so people who've like won like a radio, you know, thing. Do they have this stuff anymore? Where on the radio, you'd call in, there'd be a phone number and you'd get a free ticket. Like people do that kind of stuff. They used to do that promotional screenings and stuff like that. I don't know if they do that kind of stuff anymore.
I know. But that's how I saw my first concert. Are you kidding? I won one of those. Yeah.
I used to go to movies like that all the time. You know, there'd be like a page in the Village Voice and you'd tear it and then you'd show up somewhere and that you'd wait in line and you'd give it to them and they'd give you a ticket. So this was like seeing the new world with like civilians. And after the movie, oh my God, they hated it so much. After the movie, you know, I walked out into the lobby or the area right outside the theater, and there were people, like total strangers, bonding with each other loudly over how much they hated it. Like these people would like go up to random people and they're like, oh my God, did you hate that as much as I did? And they would talk about it. They were all loudly just like laughing and cackling and shrieking about how awful and terrible the movie was. And I remember I was seeing the movie for the second time at this point. I loved it already. And I, you know, I mean, Malik is he was a controversial director at the time, especially when he was making films that were, that still had some semblance of popular appeal, like because mm-hmm. Thin Red Line was a war movie. So I remember I saw Thin Red Line opening day at the Ziegfeld Theater, like opening day, first show of the day. So it was like, and I actually ran into a high school friend of mine, but it was like the two of us and then a bunch of like middle-aged guys who just wanted to see the new war movie, right? And it's just like all throughout the screening, we could just hear the sound of chairs folding as they left, as they walked out of the movie. So it was already, and Thin Red Line was like nominated for Oscars and stuff. So the New World had the, looked like it was going to be this sumptuous historical epic, maybe up for Oscars, blah, blah, blah. And then these people saw it and they were just like, what the fuck was that? It was kind of a flop, but it's been so nice to see it reevaluated over the years.
Wow. Because
back then, even a lot of people who really liked Malik were kind of like, ooh, I don't know about this one.
That's the opposite experience I had, which is really funny. For Thin Red Line, I still remember my parents, because it was the same year that
Saving Private Ryan.
Which was like my dad's favorite movie that year. Sure. And I remember them renting Thin Red Line and like he got up like six times to go in the other room because we were we didn't see it in the theater the first time, unfortunately. Sure. And so I think he finally gave up like midway through and just went and my mom and I were just completely compelled the whole rest of the movie. But for The New World, on Twitter there's usually a question, I mean there's always questions going around, bait asking like, what is your favorite movie going experience or what was a memorable one? And I usually will talk about seeing The New World. It was on Valentine's Day. It was a matinee. And I went just a theater across the street just at like 1 o'clock. I was single, so it was not a romantic thing. It was just a matinee. Sure. And there were only about seven of us in the theater and nobody wanted to leave at the end. Now, these were probably Malik people. Like I went because I was a Malik fan, but it was so funny. The credits start going and people got up and we were all strangers. And suddenly we were all talking to each other about this great experience we had. And, you know, wasn't that an amazing film? And nobody wanted to leave. And I remember like the employees coming in, like, why aren't these people walking out? Because you don't want to leave that dream state. And so it's really funny. It's like, Phoenix in New York, but you went to a really crowded screening, but I was probably at like the targeted Malick people on Valentine's Day who are ready for this type of thing too.
Well, but also there's nothing better than watching one of these films in a theater with an appreciative audience. And I mean, Malick, I think he's still a divisive filmmaker, but I think over the years, you know, his audience has self-selected. It's a smaller audience now. Thin Red Line is just throwing stars at you to try and get you to see it. So, it was asking for it, right? You know, people going to see the new George Clooney movie, you know?
That's so funny.
The new world was its own thing. It was a challenging proposition, but over the years, I think the Malick audience is kind of, Malick has found his audience and his audience has found him. And that's kind of who it is now. But I miss the days of having these kinds of really divisive films in theaters where, you know, you'd go to one screening and people would be like tearing their hair out. And then you'd go to another screening and people would like, it was like, you know, we'd all been through a war or something. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I miss that. I really miss that. You don't see that as much anymore. It's not like there are movies left,
not
that experience
at that level.
I miss that experience of kind of the high profile film that just divides the shit out of audiences. So there are people who hate it. There are people who love it. People are just like fighting about it. You go to a party and someone corners you to talk about it. Like, it just doesn't happen anymore. Also, I don't go to parties anymore, but it's like all these things
that you're more popular than I am. Who's having parties? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that I really do miss. And the New World was kind of the pinnacle of that sort of film, I think.
Yeah. Well, somebody I know, you, actually phrased it as like not normal or movies that are quite normal when you were writing about our next film, another just phenomenal piece. So I'm going to link to all of these basically
because people need
to read them. But up, we have a film that I know is one of your favorites, as it is, of course, that of our mutual friend, Blake Howard, and also Katie Walsh, who run an entire podcast dedicated to the film, which is the 2006 big screen version of one of the things most synonymous with Michael Mann's name, Miami Vice, written, directed, and co-produced by Mann, who was an executive producer on the 1980s NBC series of the same name, starring Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas. The film version features Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx stepping into their roles as Miami-Dade Police Department detectives James Sonny Crockett and Ricardo Rico Tubbs, respectively, going undercover to fight international drug trafficking. The film co-stars Gong Li, Naomi Harris, Kieran Hines, Justin Theroux, and more. I'm going to stop there because when it comes to this film, you are the expert, and I'm very eager to learn from you.
Miami Vice, what have I not said yet about Miami Vice?
Well, we're doing this again.
Yeah. The thing I will, and I've told the story before, but I'll tell it again because I think it's relevant. I liked Michael Mann's movies. I've always liked his movies, and you know, I was there like opening day for Last of the Mohicans and stuff, and for Heat, his films were always, there was often something about his films that was a little off for me. There was a kind of like a certain, maybe at the time I probably would have called it a self-importance, a kind of grandiosity that maybe sometimes felt unearned. Heat, for example, like, you know, I liked Heat, but you know, there are all these like little Dickensian things in Heat where it just becomes this very expansive movie. And there was a part of me that was like, oh, I just focus on the crime thriller. Why am I getting into the Natalie Portman of it all and stuff? and there were films of his at the time, like when I saw Ali, I was like, oh God, what the hell is this? I hated it. When I saw Collateral, I was like, okay, it's, you know, some of it works, some of it doesn't. Again, it's like, just a little too Michael Mann-ish for me. So for a long time, despite the fact that I saw all the films, I liked most of them, and I often revisited them, you know, he wasn't like the man for me. And okay. And it was actually Miami Vice that changed all that. You know, I saw Miami Vice at a press screening, and from that cold open through the movie, finally I was like, oh, now I get it. I was like, oh, all that extraneous stuff that I thought was unimportant to those other movies and unnecessary.
Like
that's the stuff. Like that's what he's interested in. And that's the thing that's making those movies what they are.
Yeah.
And Miami Vice to me felt like it was almost entirely composed of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was so stylized, and it was so such its own thing. I mean, it just completely pulled me into its vortex and just did not let me go until the very end. I mean, just the way it unfolds, like it's just like it just constantly pulls you.
Yeah.
And because I think the plot is, you know, just a little incoherent, at least the first time you watch it, it's a little fast.
Like, gun to my head, I could not explain this right now. Yeah,
I can, but that's because I've seen it like 300 times.
Yeah. For me, this is like time number 3 or 4, and I'm like, yeah, I get it, but yeah.
I mean, but you know, though, that like man has, you know, like I mean, there aren't any holes for him. It's just like, you know, everything is. I mean, there's certain things are very subtle or bursts of dialogue that you can't really even understand what anyone said, but that's actually like some really crucial thing to the plot. You know, I mean, he does that. But I think that also creates, at least for me, like that engages me even further because I'm like, I got to watch even more carefully. And it just kind of pulls me in. Not doesn't force me, but just it makes me more interested. It just, because it's like, because the movie's constantly one step ahead of me, it just completely, like I'm just completely swallowed up by the whole thing. And after I saw Miami Vice, I was like, oh, wait, I got to like go back and rewatch every Michael Mann movie. And of course, then I went and rewatched everyone. And I was like, all right, this guy's the greatest ever. And it just totally turned me around on his films. But I will say, and I think maybe that's, I mean, obviously, The New World had come out and I loved The New World at the time. But I think Miami Vice was also when I really started to turn around on Colin Farrell. Okay. Even though he had given good performances, because I remember when I first saw when they first released the trailer for Miami Vice, I mean, people were like, what the hell? Like, what
it's
is that?
Not
like
neon, his hair. And it's not. Yeah.
But also like his hair. What is going on? Like, why are they making Colin Farrell look like that? This was, I believe, after Alexander. Right. And, you know, I can't remember when Alexander was, but yeah. And So he was, you know, at the time I was like, oh, this is a ridiculous choice for this character. And of course, after actually seeing the movie, I was like, all right, Colin Farrell. God. All right. I have been fully Colin Farrell pilled now. and you know, his chemistry with Gong Li, is just incredible. I think it's the, you know, I think it's the most kind of electrifying on-screen chemistry I've ever seen. And in fact, on Blake, on Blake and Katie's podcast, they discovered with, you know, over the past few months, they've had a number of guests who were actually people who worked on the movie. Like they had Colin Farrell's assistant on, and then they had, you know, they had like, I think one of the sound people, I mean, they had a number of people who worked on the film. And one of the things they said was that, you know, for their scenes, for their intimate scenes together, it was like they cleared the set and it was just like, you know, the camera crew, Michael Mann, Colin Farrell, Gong Li, and a bottle of wine. And it just created this much more intimate quality to those scenes. And I think they really had great chemistry. I think they were kind of in love with each other, not necessarily, you know, I'm not saying that anything happened, but like, I think they were for the purpose, like when they were on camera, I think they were in love with each other. And that really comes through in that film.
You can't fake chemistry, and boy, do they have it. Yes. Yeah. And you bring up Michael Mann in these moments. And I think it was in your piece, you talked about it some scenes like start too soon or end too early, and then they go to the next thing. Yeah. And that it's very jarring, especially the first time you watch it. Like you bring up the scene on the highway at the beginning, right, where a character who finds out like he was an informant and his wife is killed, and then he steps out in front of traffic, and it's so shocking, but it's like almost over before it begins and you can fully register it, and then we're into the next thing. Or you said you know, we're in a club and then we're on a different case and we're just kind of chasing down all these things. But yeah, that is what Michael Mann is doing. He's kind of impressionistic. You know, there are moments where it's like, okay, we enter a totally different movie for a while, like the whole Cuba moment of the film. It's like night and day, where you know it's lighter, it's brighter, it's way sexier. I mean, there's sexy stuff that goes on with Jamie Foxx's character, of course, but it's like a totally different thing, and the movie is always changing. I was going to ask you actually before I did it. The only edition that I found, I happened to find like a used copy, was the director's cut. And, you know, Blake reads me the riot act, like the boat thing at the beginning, it drives me nuts. And, you know, Jen, ignore the boat thing. And so I was going to ask, did I watch the wrong edition this time?
You watched the director's cut, the director's extended edition. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe that there is a wrong version of my advice.
It's all good, basically.
It's all good. You did miss the cold open
In the club. I remember that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is one of the great openings of any movie ever. And so to miss that, to lose that is heartbreaking. But
I had seen
but
that.
Also. Like that scene that scene with the boats is great. I mean, you can see why he put it back in there, because it's clear they spent a lot of money.
Yeah, and you know who these guys are.
Yeah, and I mean, it actually provides really important context. But the beauty of it is that it actually reveals all the things that the movie refuses to do, which is to provide that kind of context. So it's like, you can see why it's there. It's gorgeous. It's beautifully shot. You get to see more Isaac de Bankole, which is always a good thing. But then you're like, no, cut it. You got to cut it. You can't. This is kill your darlings. And that is one of the darlings. There is actually, I believe, some friends of Blake's have created the ideal Miami Vice cut, which they call the Miami Nice cut in honor of the podcast, which is basically the director's cut, but with the cold open. So you lose the boat thing at the end, because actually the director's cut has some really important and really good scenes that the theatrical release version, which, you know, the Miami Vice heads tend to prefer the theatrical release version, but the director's cut also has much more Naomi Harris, and she's great. And there's a lot of really beautiful stuff with her and her character that that you don't want to lose. So actually the Miami Nice cut, if you can find it, and I'm sure you can, because many of us can help you find it.
Yes.
Yeah. But that is probably the ideal version of the movie.
Okay. So we got to like get somebody to get in touch with Blake, you know, our people call their people, and, you know, release this thing. I guess there's also a music cue that has changed at the end, but I can't remember what it is. Blake's probably going to kill me when he listens.
I believe it's In the Air Tonight.
I don't like the new version, I have to say. Yeah.
The new version isn't good. I think what happened is, if I remember correctly, at the time, you know, Miami Vice came out, it was not a big hit. No. And I think among the criticisms was like, where the hell is In the Air Tonight?
Yeah. So synonymous with the show. Come on.
Yeah. And I think I hope I'm not misremembering this, but I believe that for the director's cut, director's extended edition, Mann put that music cue in, but it's like the cover version. So it adds insult to injury for a lot of people. I don't mind that version, but obviously the original, that version is, it's interesting because that version of the song, I think, is a good example of how I think Mann himself saw this Miami Vice, and it reflects how he saw how Miami
that,
had changed
the tone.
Like it reflects how he he would probably use the word muscular. He likes that word to describe Miami, more muscular. Like it's harder. It's not quite as intimate. It's kind of just a more alienating, edgier sound because it's like the hard rock version of In the Air. but like what makes Miami Vice so special is that intimate quality of that song. And I would argue that while Man is clearly correct about how Miami has changed over the years, and his film of Miami Vice is obviously very different than the show Miami Vice, totally different. But there are certain qualities it shares, not stylistically, but emotionally, existentially, with the show, that it still shares those things. And I'm not sure he's entirely aware that he's accomplished that. I think Michael Mann has a complicated relationship to this movie because I think he, you know, I think it was a kind of a troubled production, and then they had to scrap their ending and they scrap their final locations and things because of a variety of things.
Hurricanes and a bunch of problems.
And if you ever find it in yourself to listen to every single episode of Miami Nice, eventually a picture emerges of what happened. So no, it's just, you know, he had to make some compromises to his vision. And they weren't necessarily compromises that he wanted to make. And I think he's kind of torn on whether the film works or not. Like, I think he might be, it's possible that he's kind of, you know, filmmakers are like that. They tend to adopt the popular prevailing opinion of their movies at the time that they're released. Like Billy Wilder would talk about, you know, the films of his that flopped as the failures. And then you'd be like, no, these are great movies. Like people just didn't appreciate them at the time. That's their problem, not yours.
I know.
You know, Leon Vitali, who was Stanley Kubrick's assistant, once told me that, you know, they, sometime, I guess it would have been sometime in the 90s, maybe it was the 80s, but like, you know, a British channel had a season of Stanley Kubrick movies, and they watched them. He and Stanley Kubrick watched them, and Stanley Kubrick watched Barry Lyndon after all these years. And he had been, you know, Barry Lyndon had been widely criticized at the time, and he was very defensive about it at the time. So he had never publicly said anything about Barry Lyndon. But then, you know, he, I guess, watched it on TV when it aired on British TV. And he said to, I don't remember the exact quote, but he said something to Leon Vitali like, you know, it's pretty good.
I love it.
And it was like, surprise. Yeah. It's my favorite film. And I think it Kubrick was surprised. He was like, oh, wait, this works. Huh? You know, maybe people were wrong. So I think filmmakers can get kind of too stuck in
cause and effect and like box office and
and other, like, to them it's got, they're kind of stuck in the, they released
what
it
happened.
People didn't like it, I fucked up, you know, gotta move on. They don't necessarily think that way, but they're sort of, part of their impression of a movie maybe is stuck in that, especially filmmakers who are also businessmen, you know, who do actually pay attention to things like box office, you know?
I love that this was the movie that really made you reevaluate Michael Mann and his whole career, because he's one of those filmmakers who, just like we talked about with Malick, kind of going to the same thesis again and again and revisiting it. And that is Michael Mann essentially. And, you know, even just the digital, like this and Collateral, like if you watch these back to back, you mentioned the music, and that's what kind of kicked it off in my mind. The way he uses Audio Slave a little bit. It just kind of goes right with it. Or Moby, who we hear in Heat, or just the look of the film, or that code that he kind of has with his masculine code of, you know, that goes all the way back to like Thief. And you really kind of do see a pattern emerge when you start looking at all of these films. And so I love that Miami Vice kind of kicked it off and made you go back. So this is your favorite Michael Mann, I'm guessing?
No, I mean, I think I would still say Heat is my favorite Michael Mann. I mean, I think Heat is just, you know, it's a monumental movie. But this is, you know, this is the, I mean, this is the one I rewatch the most.
Favorite and best probably, can be different.
And one day I will probably decide that it's my favorite of his. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I mean, it's just when I watch it, I can't imagine watching any other movie, you know?
Yeah.
There's some films that are like that. While you're watching it, you're like, why do I ever bother to watch other movies? Like, why don't I just watch this for the rest of my life, you know? And Miami Vice is one of those films. But Heat is one of those films too. You know, watching Heat, I'm like,
it pulls you in. Yeah.
Why should this ever end?
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, our fourth film today was my favorite movie from 2008. Writer-director Martin McDonagh's irreverent pitch-black dramedy In Bruges, starring a pitch-perfect Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson as two disgraced Irish hitmen hiding out in the gorgeous Belgian city of Bruges while they wait for word from their volatile, unpredictable boss, played by Ralph Fiennes, like a cross between Ray Winstone, Michael Caine, Bob Hoskins, Terrence Stamp, and Ben Kingsley as Don Logan and Sexy Beast, essentially. He's all those rolled into one. Shockingly funny, vile, yet able to sneak up on you with heartbreak and pathos as it reaches its conclusion. It's truly great. It garnered Farrell the Golden Globe for Best Actor, Musical, or Comedy over his co-star, who was nominated in the same category. But it's such a vital two-hander between them both that I'm very excited by the news that they've reteamed with McDonagh on a film project releasing this fall. But that obviously will call for a whole different podcast conversation. So for now, why don't you weigh in on In Bruges?
I did not know that they were reteaming. That's incredible news.
I guess October. Wow. I don't know what it's about though.
Wow, that's
so
awesome.
Exciting.
So you know, speaking of films that my opinion has changed on, I remember I had to review In Bruges when it came out. And I haven't revisited my review. I believe it was for nerve.com, which doesn't exist anymore. Mm. I probably have a Word document somewhere on my computer, but I remember I was kind of mixed on it. And part of it was that you know, it's such a kind of far-fetched isn't the word, but you know, it's such a I'm trying to figure out the right expression. I should have read my review. It's such a contrived story.
Yes.
Right. And it's not, there's nothing realistic about it. Like these are characters out of pop culture, right? They're, I mean, and it's like Tarantino, obviously. You know, it's like, you know, the bantery hitman, you know, duo who like real life assassins aren't like this. Pretty sure, you know, and this is such a film world contrivance, these kind of Gabby, garrulous, philosophical, you know, funny hitmen who work in teams. And, you know, when they're not busy, you know, killing people, they're having interesting conversations. So to give us characters like that, but then to sort of give them this, like, what felt to me like unearned pathos of, well, you know, he shot the priest, but he also shot this little boy on the other side of the thing by accident. Mm-hmm. So now he feels guilt. I'm like, none of these things happened, you know, like this didn't happen, that thing that happened, and therefore this other thing didn't happen. And so like, I'm being asked to sort of worry about the, you know, the spiritual moral dilemma of a character that already doesn't exist, that you kind of came up with as a movie contrivance. Mm-hmm. So like this shocking, horrible thing that happened to him never felt real to me. Mm-hmm. So in that context, I was like, this, you know, like, yes, the movie is lovely. There's great music. The performances are great, but like, I'm being asked to care about something that just makes no, you know, makes no sense to me. But you know, the thing is, Colin Farrell is fucking fantastic in it, and he makes you care.
Yeah.
like, that's the thing. He gets it. He doesn't give a realistic performance. There's nothing realistic about this performance. It's practically commedia dell'arte. It's so exaggerated at times. Mm-hmm. It can be so broad. Again, that face of his. I mean, this movie is maybe the most expressive his face has ever been.
Yeah. When you were saying that earlier, I was thinking in Bruges and all the faces. Yep.
Yeah. And like I mean, he's still, there's still gifs from this movie it's like, you know, with him like, you know, throwing up his hands and stuff like that. So they are cartoons in a sense, and he's a cartoon in this movie, but he's so good, and he's able to I mean, that scene at the end or towards the end when he's crying over you know, Brendan Gleeson's character has thrown himself off the tower. And I mean, again, totally contrived. Like, you know, this is not a thing that happens in real life. Like, why should I care about this?
Yeah.
This is totally far-fetched. This is utterly ridiculous. But Colin Farrell crying over his friend is so devastating.
Yeah.
He makes you care. And I, you know, and over the years, I've rewatched this movie multiple times. I love it. It's there's so many great things about it. Like my initial ambivalence toward the movie has completely evaporated, and now I love watching it. But I think that, you know, Colin Farrell's performance is kind of the key to it. Mm-hmm. And again, he does a thing where he's a character who you really shouldn't like. I mean, he's kind of a complete jerk, you know, incredibly offensive jerk, ignorant, all of these things. Also happens to have murdered a child. Like, at what point are we supposed to care for this person? And yet we do. You know, like,
it's got a lot going on. It is ridiculous, but it's also, I mean, that is taken literally. You know, you can also view it as sort of like a Catholic parable, a little bit of heaven, hell,
it's
and purgatory.
Symbolic.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's the don't look now allusions, like they even say don't look now because we have dwarf characters. And, you know, also there's a little bit of the third man going on in the end. I love the introduction of the Ralph Fiennes character. Like, we don't see him until he, you know, beats the hell out of that phone.
Yeah,
it's just an amazing reveal. I'm big on the way that they introduce characters, especially somebody like that. It's incredible. I think just the cast is good. You really shouldn't care about these people at all. I was watching an interview with McDonough where he was talking about how he had taken a day trip for a couple days over there. And he's like, basically it was the two sides of my brain. You know, part of me is, I should sightsee, but I'm so fucking bored. And like, I should do this, but maybe I'll just go get drunk and get laid. And like, you know, so he wanted to do like two different things and just made it two different people, which is kind of an old creative writing exercise. Sure. Like, put two people in the room. One wants to leave. One wants to, you know, stay. Mm-hmm. And so it is, you know, you have these two guys who couldn't be more different, but you also have a father and a son sort of relationship. Mm-hmm. They just work so well together. It is a play we're watching. I mean, that's kind of all of his films are extremely verbal, and there's a lot going on. I mean, it's you're laughing so hard at something screamingly funny. And then a couple seconds later, it just, like, when we find out what's going on or what had happened with Brendan Gleeson's wife, I mean, you're just completely devastated. So this movie has a lot of twists, a lot of turns, and it makes you care, as you were saying, and we should not care. Yes.
Well, that scene where Ralph Fiennes' character tells Brendan Gleeson's character what his mission is.
Yes.
But he never says it.
Mm-hmm.
The way he sort of describes the way he, you know, the way they kind of talk about Ray, is it Ray, his name, the Colin Farrell's character's name?
I think it might be. Yeah.
But then he starts talking about him in the past tense.
Yes. It's that subtle.
Yeah. And it's funny because I always forget that it's that subtle.
Yeah.
Like, I just, for some reason in my head, there's a scene where they're like, you're going to kill this guy, you know? And he never really says it. Like, it's just like, so it's very subtle and just incredibly like chilling, spine chilling. Yeah. Of course, that's also because Ralph Fiennes is just so damn good.
It's something but, like, I'm glad we could have done this for him or something like that. And you're like, whoa. Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, they're not in Bruges to get out of the, you know, to, so that this can be done in some, you know, in some dark corner of Europe. It really is like, oh yeah, I just, I wanted him to have like a nice trip before we killed him.
A last hurrah.
And the film sticks with that, like his moral code, you know, Ralph Fiennes at the end when he kills himself because he thinks he shot a child. Yep. And it's also, I mean, that's such a problematic thing. It's like, you know, I mean, he still shot a human being.
I know,
like,
right?
But it's like, the movie's like, oh no, it was a dwarf, but he thinks it was a child.
Yeah,
it's like, what's the, like, still a completely innocent human being.
It's still a human being, yes.
Yeah. But the way he kills himself at the end, I mean, that was totally unexpected. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing about this film is that it never quite does what you think it's going to do.
No. Doesn't play by any rules. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it would be an interesting double feature with Phone Booth because it is, you know, I mean, this is a much better movie than Phone Booth.
Oh,
And Phone Booth is a lot of fun and this is a lot of fun, but this is a much better movie than Phone Booth. And, but you know, the way the two movies use Colin Farrell is interesting, but also the way the two movies use voice is interesting. I mean, this movie does so much more with voice than Phone Booth, which is a movie all about voice. I mean, Kiefer Sutherland is basically just like a one-note psycho. Whereas here, it's like, you know, the Ralph Fiennes' voice becomes this like such a, you know, interesting phenomenon in and of itself.
I know, like when the message comes through, you know, like fuck me, he swears a lot. You know, like I can't remember if we hear.
We hear it.
We hear it. Oh my God. Yeah. It's perfect. Yeah. But you don't see him for the longest time.
Yeah.
Well, our final and most recent film today is Greek filmmaker. You got to help me on this name here.
Yorgos Lanthimos
is The Lobster, which introduces us to a society where single people are given just 45 days to find partners or they will be turned into an animal of their choice. Starring Farrell as a bookish, slightly out of shape, short-sighted man who finds himself under the gun after his wife leaves him for another man. We follow him first to a hotel where he must submit to all kinds of things in order to hopefully form a match alongside fellow singles, John C. Reilly and Ben Whishaw, before Farrell escapes and joins an outlaw group called the Loners, run by Leah Seydoux, where coupling is forbidden, and he falls for fellow loner Rachel Weisz. Very original and very disturbing, but artistically singular and hard to forget. I'll let you start us off on The Lobster.
The Lobster was, I think it's the first time that the deadpan qualities of Colin Farrell's, you know, persona were used. I mean, it's, you know, Lanthimos, I think this was his first English language film. And it's you know, it was really a revelation to see. Mm-hmm. First of all, I mean, you know, Colin Farrell, chubby, which of course he still looks amazing. I mean, it's just like first you say, oh my God, Colin Farrell gained all this weight. I'm like, yeah, he still looks, I would kill to look like that still. But you know, I mean, the way that the film uses his ability to be completely still and yet be utterly transfixing is and Lanthimos also uses this in Killing of a Sacred Deer in a movie whose tone is much different, but yeah, I mean, it was really a revelation to see Colin Farrell do this, because it shows you, I mean, this is really range. It's not just he can play different characters, but like he can play like a completely different form. Like he can be in a completely, you know, a style of filmmaking that, you know, is completely other than what he's been doing so far. Mm-hmm. And when you see him in something like this, you just think to yourself, he can exist in so many different worlds, like so many different cinematic worlds.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that he was so all in on this and then the Killing of a Sacred Deer. And I think, you know, he and Lanthimos are trying to work together again. And I mean, it's just, it's so, you know, it was really exciting to see him in this. And he's so, you know, and the film knows how to use him because it doesn't just let him. I mean, the deadpan stuff is great. And the film is, you know, I mean, it's, you're watching an absolutely monstrous dystopia, but it's so funny the way it unfolds, yes. The way it just uses that surreal, surrealism, but also kind of just the sheer absurdity of how it works and the way it's cut together. I mean, is that great, you know, the first time it cuts to them in the bus with their rifles, it's just up until that point, it's just like, once it cuts to that, you're just like, you can't help but giggle.
What am I watching? Yeah.
And it's just like with each scene, the whole thing just gets crazier and crazier and crazier.
Yeah.
And, but it's so controlled that you just in the crazier it gets, though, the more you feel like you're in the hands of a master filmmaker. Like it never gets control. It never goes crazy where you're like, oh my God, what is going on? I have no idea what's happening.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be here anymore. It's like, oh, this is really leading me towards something interesting. But then, you know, every once in a while, it really uses again that plastic quality of his face, his ability to convey so much with his expressions. You know, when the heartless woman, I believe she's called.
Oh my God. You know,
kills his brother.
Who is
a dog. And, you know, when he's trying to be completely deadpan and he goes into the bathroom and he's like crying and he's like, no, yeah. these aren't tears. I was just washing my face. And I mean, it's just hilarious, but it's also heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And it's like the film sort of breaks a little bit at that moment, just to sort of show us the character breaking. So you realize, oh, you know, like we're in this world of just like zero emotion, but emotions still exist. You know, like it's not that emotions don't exist. Like it's not like we're watching a movie where emotions don't exist. We're watching a place where emotions don't exist, but emotions do exist in this world. And every once in a while they break through and it's incredible. I love this movie. Every time I watch it, it just gets greater and greater and greater.
Yeah, we're watching him operate on a number of levels in character. We're watching like thinking happen, which is a hard thing to accomplish.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are moments where, you know, exactly what you mentioned, it at the beginning, you said it gets progressively weirder with every scene where you are just completely dying for this man. It's so lonely and it's so tragic initially. And then, you know, like when he gets checked into the hotel and it's, you know, only whole sizes of the shoes and you're like, is this funny? And when you're first watching it, you're like, I don't know what's going on. And then he's trying on different personas out of loneliness. And it's going into the melancholy and the pathos, the humanism that we have, that he is so easy, or he can easily access as an actor. And it works really well because he changes several times throughout this movie, like as you were mentioning, deadpan as it is, and as absurd and funny and shocking as this movie is, he goes through a lot from start to finish. He's a different person by the end of it. And yeah, it's surprising. It sneaks up on you. You're all of a sudden realizing, you know, this is crazy and I'm laughing and should I be laughing? And then by the end of it, wow, when did this suddenly become super moving? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so allegorical, clearly. I mean, there's so many things about it where you're like, I mean, as crazy as this world is, you know, you're like, it does feel like it's almost a reflection on, I mean, it's a great metaphor for, how, you know, coupling works, where you're either like completely in the world of couples or you are just like cast to the walls.
Yeah, you're deficient.
And this idea that these two worlds never meet. I mean, it's a silly idea, but that's how life is sometimes, you know?
And how you feel sometimes. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It was weird how like, once I got married, it was like harder to see my single friends,
mm-hmm.
not because like I didn't want to see them, but because like I was doing things with couples, you know? And then
you're in that couple vibe. Yep.
Yeah. And I don't even know that this is what Lanthimos was going for, but that's absolutely, there's something very true about, you know, the utterly absurdist world that this film presents. And so you can kind of imagine how he came up with it, you know?
You like losing your identity or changing to fit whoever you happen to be with at the moment, you know, that happens sometimes in relationships. I mean, sure. Jane Fonda was famous for saying that with each man she was with there for a couple decades, she was a different person. Yeah.
And the bitterness he still has when he reconnects with, you know, when he joins the resistance and, you know, he finds Ben Whishaw and his wife. And he's just like, yeah, he doesn't really have nosebleeds. Like, it's like that. It's like he had to let him know. The film is so good and it feels so true that like, I almost have like a anxiety attack watching it, you know, mm-hmm. start to break out in hives. As absurd as the whole thing is, you're like, way too close for comfort, you know. Yes. It's just so incisive about human emotions and just the way human relationships work sometimes. And that sense, like that ticking clock sense in the hotel, mm-hmm. where like you have 2 weeks and then if you don't, you're gonna get turned into an animal. Crazy.
Watching it as a single woman in the middle of a pandemic was like, holy shit, did you do this, Bill? No.
was this your first time seeing it?
Revisiting it for the first time in years. Because I remember liking it, but then watching it again, I'm like, oh my god, yes.
It's every time I watch it, I'm like, whoa, this movie is way more realistic than I thought it was, you know?
Yeah. So abstract, but you're watching it. Just the entire cast is so good. Olivia Colman is great. Coleman, what she can incredible. Do with her voice is always good.
They're
all good.
Her ability to just be like this totally official.
Yes.
Smug, calm, weirdly compassionate, but totally heartless. She's so great. There's just so many layers.
Always good.
I think Lanthimos is a great director of actors. I think he's proven that with his films now. Mm-hmm. But he's one of those filmmakers, clearly puts a lot of work into these things. And we love that, but I'm kind of mm-hmm. like, I would love to see just like a new movie from him every year, you know?
Anything else that's out there.
A true original, as they say.
Well, obviously those are the ones we chose, all we had time for, so I don't monopolize Bilga's entire evening. But in over 20 years, Farrell has made many other great ones, including some of the ones we referenced along the way. For those listening who might still be catching up, which other films would you recommend that they seek out?
I think he's really good in The Batman. as the Penguin. It's like, that's the thing. It's, you know, he's under just so much makeup. So it doesn't actually use those classic qualities of his face, but he does great things in it. You know, people love After Yang. I didn't love it as much, but he's very good in it. I should probably see After Yang again, but you know, he's great in Killing of a Sacred Deer. He's great in Miss Julie, Liv Ullmann's adaptation of Miss Julie. He's playing opposite Jessica Chastain. Mm-hmm. I think he's very good in The Beguiled. A couple of lesser known films. He's great in Peter Weir's The Way Back, which I believe was the last film Peter Weir made.
I haven't seen that in ages, but yeah, that was good.
And I think, Peter Weir kind of like sort of retired, I think, afterwards. So that was the last film he did, I believe. You know, our friend Blake is in the process of resurrecting the Peter Weir filmography with, you know, Master and Commander. So, he's great in Neil Jordan's Ondine.
That was a good film.
He and Neil Jordan, I feel like that was a good match, and I'd be curious to see them work more. Mm-hmm. Two Irishmen. one thing I have not seen yet. Well, actually, I think Colin Farrell is actually great in the second season of True Detective, which was a controversial season. And I believe kind of a controversial performance, but I thought he was fantastic in it. I have not yet seen The North Water, the show, the whaling show that he does. Did you know about this?
No, I didn't.
Colin Farrell as a whaler.
Sign me up.
The North Water. I mean, it's just like totally under the radar. I still haven't seen it. I know it exists. I've known it exists for a while. It's like on my list. I'm just so bad about watching TV shows that it just takes me a while to commit to one of them. And I know this is going to be one that I need. I mean, I'm just like obsessed with whaling. I'm obsessed with the sea. I'm obsessed with sailors. I'm obsessed with Colin Farrell.
It's Andrew hitting Hay, all those directed. Targets. Yeah.
It's like, it was like created in a lab for me. And yet I've somehow not watched it.
Yeah. His name is Barry Lyndon. No, I'm just kidding. But.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one I'm looking forward to seeing. You can kind of can't go wrong with him these days, I feel like. For my list, to update my list, I watched this movie, Voyagers, which came out, I think, last year. I think it was last year. It was a pandemic release, I'm pretty sure. And I don't even know if it technically was ever in theaters, but it's a sci-fi film about a mission to another planet that humans are going to colonize. Have you seen it?
No.
Have you seen Voyagers?
No.
It's a mission to another planet that humans are going to colonize, but it's going to take so long that they send out it's a big space mission, like 60 people or something like that, and it's all kids. Mm-hmm. Along the way they are going to reproduce, and it's like their kids are going to be the ones who actually make it to these kids are, they're going to, you know, live and die on this space mission.
Okay.
And Colin Farrell is the adult sent with them. So he's like the sort of very calm, I don't know what his actual profession is, if he's like a psychiatrist or something, some other sort of scientist. But he is kind of overseeing this mission. And initially the kids are being given, they're being given some kind of medication to kind of quell their hormones and like quell their, to basically keep them emotionally in check. And then of course they realize, they become teenagers and they realize they're being given this, and they stop taking it, and everything goes, it basically turns into like, you know, Lord of the Flies, but like with more sex. By this point, no spoilers, but Colin Farrell's character has made his exit from the movie, for a while, the idea that of all these characters, like Colin Farrell is playing the sort of the calm, rational, responsible one. I was like, wow, we've come a long way, haven't we, from Colin Farrell? Like once upon a time, Colin Farrell would have been one of those kids, you know, just going crazy on that ship. But now he's just like the calm, adult figure of authority. So I thought that was interesting. He's very good in it. I mean, the movie's it's not great, but it's kind of worth seeing for him alone.
Well, it sounds interesting. Bilga, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It was just such a joy. I always learn so much. So a true pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Always happy to do this.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.